is very difficult to shift these beliefs, but we can challenge them when we understand how they came about and the fact that they do feel like truth, but we can have more life experiences which challenge that truth.
Hi, I'm Matt Penny, coming to you from the Blue Room Theatre's Winter Nights 2020. Discourse is at the heart of Winter Nights, and since we can't all gather at the venue to have discussions, we're bringing you a weekly podcast throughout August to hear about different areas of arts practice. These conversations are taking place on the lands of the Whadjuk people of the Noongar Nation, and we pay respect to their elders past, present and future. We acknowledge and respect their continuing culture and the contributions they make to the arts and to the life of this city. Today you'll be hearing from Georgie Ivers about the feast and the famine and making a living in the arts. She will be exploring financial security and long-term financial thinking, and will be exploring the financial journeys of established artists. Winter Nights is proudly presented with the support of the Mindaroo Foundation and a conversations partner, the City of Perth.
Money and I are old friends. We're not on the best of terms.
Money and I, our relationship is almost an illusion.
Anxiety when I don't have it, and guilt when I do.
Money to me is like a pot plant that I always feel like I'm going to kill, but I never do.
Sound familiar? My name's Georgie, and welcome to The Feast and the Famine, a podcast for emerging artists exploring long-term financial survival. Each episode, we will tackle a new topic, share research and resources, and hear some hard-won wisdom from established artists. In this episode, we'll be talking about money mindsets. How do we, as artists, behave around money? And where does that behavior come from? And can we change it? We'll be speaking to Sarah Borg, who is a mum, actress and practicing psychologist at Green Room Psychology here in Perth.
You can't kind of plan that more money will be coming in the future. You've really got to make do with what you've got and work out how that's going to work.
And I'll also be talking to a very special mystery guest as I uncover my own relationship with money.
I'd got down to $4 in my account, and probably it was a few weeks before the next money was coming in. And I remember thinking, oh God, you know, what am I going to do?
But before we get into that, let's set the scene. It's July 2020. We've slowly eased the lockdown in Perth, and today is cold but not too wet. A man on the train asks if my audio recorder is a breathalyzer, and he looks visibly relieved when I tell him, no, it's not. I arrive at Greens & Co. in Leederville, where I talk to Michelle Hall, Perth artist known as the Dirty Mother, about my concept for this podcast. It was Michelle who first talked to me about the idea of the feast and the famine.
What I mean is that I suppose I never expected to have a consistent income and an ever-increasing standard of living working in the arts. That that's not necessarily a bad thing. Feast and famine meaning that there are times where opportunities are abound and you're in a good place, maybe even physically with your health and your housing situation and things, you're in a good place and you can work and you can yield money and you can put that away, and that becomes your norm, that you have a cycle of, okay, this is a time when there's work and a particular government is in power or a certain city council is offering funding and I have jobs, so I'll work and I'll take that work and I'll put my money away, because I know that quite soon there'll be the opposite side of the cycle, which is I won't have employment, or I will need to invest some of that money that I've saved into a new project. Does that make sense? Is that what I talked about before? Yeah, it's definitely a cyclical thing. And actually, I think it's fundamental to life anyway. And that's definitely something that I've observed as I get older, is that there is no, there's no consistent pathway. It's an undulating landscape of times of doing okay and times of really feeling like you're really stuck, or you're really financially and maybe also emotionally in the gutter. But I mean, like, sometimes it isn't that far away from that. Like, sometimes you don't have somewhere to live, and you're depending on friends, aren't you? You're depending on friends to just put you up for a few months. That certainly happened to me, especially when I lived overseas. I didn't have a support network at all. So it's like, well, if I want to keep doing this job, if I want to keep developing my skills in the arts and my experience base, then I've got to take the work that's coming, and it's work I want to do, and it's work that's important and exciting, but I'm not going to yield much money from it. So I've got to live in someone's shed, or I've got to live on someone's sofa. And I can do that as long as I feed myself other ways through the depth and the richness of the work I'm doing, and as long as I keep sight of the fact that it is temporary.
COVID-19 was the beginning of a lot of financial reflection or panic for me. I knew I wasn't making enough money to live comfortably. Was that really going to change? I sat down and worked out that as a freelance videographer and theatre artist in my first year in the industry, my income had sat at around $25,000. I had no idea what that meant. So I Googled the poverty line in Australia. For a single person, the University of New South Wales and the Australian Council of Social Service places the poverty line at $457 per week before deducting household costs. So that's about $23,764 a year. Now, if that's setting off alarm bells for you, it certainly did for me. I think because we don't talk about money, it was very hard for me to understand how my income compared to other people in our industry. And while I feel very privileged to earn what I earn and work how I work, this was still a bit of a shock. So why is it that even when I was sitting just above the poverty line, I felt so bloody guilty about wanting to earn more? Turns out, like many things, our beliefs about money come from childhood.
Those beliefs that we hold and those patterns that we engage in, you know, some of them consciously, some of them subconsciously, all of those patterns do stem back to the blueprint that was laid out for us during our sort of earlier life. So sort of in critical developmental stages of our life, so things like infancy, particular times in childhood, adolescence, young adulthood, those times when sort of our brain is still developing, our social capacity, our sort of the way we conduct ourselves and what we kind of believe about ourselves, all that stuff, is growing sort of in that first sort of stage of our life. And those sort of beliefs, whether they're about, like I say, about our identity, about money, about our relationship with another person, our relationship with work, our relationship with money, our relationship with the world around us, all of those beliefs are based on those early life experiences. So they will be different from person to person. But we believe them with the absolute kind of conviction that we believe that the sky is blue. It is very difficult to shift these beliefs, but we can challenge them when we understand how they came about and the fact that, you know, they do feel like truth, but we can have more in life experiences which challenge that truth.
In the field of financial psychology, there's been a lot of research into classifying the types of behaviour people have when it comes to money. It's worth checking out the ABC's The Pineapple Project, hosted by Claire Hooper, for more detail on this. I'll post a link to this podcast on the Instagram before the next episode. It goes through different money personality types. Super, super useful. For me, however, I didn't have to look very far to see my money habits reflected back at me.
What did your parents used to say to you about money or not say in the case of your dad?
It was something that we as children weren't supposed to ask questions about or talk about.
That's our mystery guest, my mum.
We had two things going on in our family. Mum with the we haven't got enough, we can't afford it, and a sense right from when I was about three of being kind of precarious around money, like there wasn't enough because dad wasn't working. So there was this kind of awareness of lack really early on. And then later, when I wanted to know more, when dad, you know, he had a good job and he was responsible and the money was coming in, but he always put a part of it away in a pension fund, and that was for him and mum, you know, in sort of 40 years to retire. But it meant for some reason we were always short on money. And there was always this idea that you didn't talk about money, that people would somehow use it against you if you had money. So it was like it was a liability from the point of view of being able to make friends. It meant, you know, you were showing off if you said you had lots of money, if there was no shortage of money. That's why I say, you know, money not being a good friend. If it was a good friend, I would have welcomed it and been happy to have it and that sort of thing. But I was always feeling a bit like I didn't deserve it, or that I shouldn't show off about it, that it was not okay to have it somehow. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's spot on. So what might a practicing psychologist who's also an artist have to say about this?
When you first started out as an actress, what was your relationship with money like?
Largely transactional, I think. Money was like a nuts and bolts thing to help me engage with life. So I always had a part-time job from sort of my early teens. And I think very early on, because I was always sort of working in paid employment part-time whilst doing sort of amateur shows or that sort of thing, it really quickly established me in the pattern of that juggle between paid employment and sort of, well, what I was doing at the time with non-paid artwork, which I think maybe instilled a bit of an unhelpful belief around the idea that working as an artist wasn't necessarily a valid paid sort of career. I think very early on, when I did get sort of paid acting gigs, it usually paid quite well, you know, if it was a little commercial or a little voiceover or whatever that you were doing on the side. And it then again created a bit of a rule of, well, when you do get paid for your art, it's incredibly intoxicating and it's incredibly fruitful. And I would then use that money for kind of, I guess, decadent things, because it was a bit of a treat. And so it was definitely an abrupt shift going from, as much as my sort of hospo admin jobs, you know, I certainly wasn't getting a great wage and it was always casual, but there was always a baseline amount of money there. I definitely wasn't used to the sort of dips between contracts. So it was sort of quite all or nothing. I'd be either doing my acting work and that would be paying the bills at the time, but certainly not in a lavish way that I associated with acting work. But that became my, you know, my bread and butter money. But then there were these down periods where I'd have to kind of rush to obtain casual work again. And it was just a little bit more up and down and required a hell of a lot of organisation and brain space and sort of just confidence in going, there will be money. I'm sure there will be money. I'm not sure where it's going to come from, but there will be money.
Yeah, I think that's so relatable, because I think that for me going into the industry, I had what I imagine would be considered an optimism bias about my ability to succeed in the industry. And it was kind of like this idea that, like, you know, I know a lot of smart people have struggled with this before, but like, I'll make it work. And it's just it's a huge amount of pressure to put on yourself in a way, because you're expecting yourself to reinvent the wheel when all these smart people have come before you and have decided that, you know, the best way for them to support their practice is to be a teaching artist as well. And I think it's really interesting how our ideas around success in the arts is sometimes tied into being able to have like a single artistic stream of income in order to survive. And I feel like it's just, it's almost copying and pasting like a mindset that's maybe appropriate for a full-time 9-to-5 job onto an industry that's never functioned that way.
Yeah. And I think that that's, I sort of, I definitely started out with that mindset. I had the goal of, I want to pay all my bills using my acting work. That's what I want to do. And I really kind of persisted with great tenacity to do that for a couple of years. But then I realized this is exhausting. It was sort of the unexpected, just the daily sort of going, okay, where, how much have I got and where is that going? You know, just the constant kind of having to have money on my mind, irrespective of whether there was money there or not, but just the idea of, you know, having to have money from this one source became quite an exhausting thing for me. Whereas now I have sort of a number of different income streams, and that's kind of exhausting in a similar way, because you're sort of, you're jumping from being a PAYG sort of employee versus a sole trader versus contract, all the different stuff. So you've got to be across a whole lot of different sort of, I guess, financial contexts, which is exhausting in a way. But what I'm no longer exhausted with is that sort of constant, is the money going to be there? So I'm still exhausted in the how much is there, where is it coming from, when's it going to be there? But I don't have that, is it going to be there, which I think is part and parcel of making sure that you do have diverse income streams.
Yeah. And so what was the tipping point when you decided, because you must have done your psych degree, when you started it, was it very much with the intention of needing to have that kind of more reliable income, or was there a point where you had to decide, okay, how am I going to balance this new practice with my arts practice?
Yeah, it was a little bit of all of that. I started studying psychology. I was still very much kind of my sort of full-time day job was a jobbing actor. But I started studying psychology because I had a lot of downtime, and I'm not used to that. So sort of downtime when I was working medial kind of boring mundane jobs while I was kind of, you know, auditioning and that sort of thing. So I felt really frustrated with that. I felt like it wasn't a good use of my time. It wasn't a good use of my brain. And I think I reached my late 20s and realized I don't want to be like this in 20 years' time. I do want to kind of live a life with this guy who I'm in love with, and I want to have a family, and I actually really want to use my brain and my skills. So that was definitely a point where I realized, okay, I need to find another skill so that I sort of feel like a competent adult, I think. And I know that's not the same for everybody, but certainly for me, that association between sort of just doing casual jobs where I really felt disempowered and out of control. I wanted my work to feel more like I was a driving force behind it. So I started studying psychology with the sort of thought that I would, you know, create workshops or sort of provide resources around kind of coping with nerves, coping with performance anxiety.
Yeah, that's fabulous. That actually leads into my next question, which is a bit kind of more about things that you might have insight into through your practice working with artists. In terms of mindsets around money, do you think there are any kind of common approaches or maybe problems that a lot of artists seem to have when it comes to managing money?
Yeah, when I'm thinking about people that I've worked with, both sort of therapeutically or sort of just anecdotally in conversations and stuff, it does seem that that concept of finances is an ongoing stressor in the arts world. And I think in some ways, if we think of stresses purely as sort of, they're not negative or positive, but stresses are an indication that we need to respond or adjust to something. Finances are always going to be a stressor in the arts world because by the very nature of, you know, the fact that having a regular, hearty kind of pot of gold is just not something that we would generally expect when you're embarking on this sort of career. So therefore, money will always be a stressor that's on the plate because we're always having to adjust and respond to the concept of money. I mean, I think patterns, just thinking kind of anecdotally, patterns that I see which might be a little bit unhelpful are avoidance. So this
yes.
not just linked to money, but the idea generally that if something feels difficult or we don't understand it or it confuses us or it makes us feel unpleasant, we avoid it, which with money is probably one of the worst things that you can do. Or likewise, avoidance in terms of not properly seeing what's there in front of you. So sort of avoidance where you kind of put it away and don't look at it, or avoidance when you interpret it as, oh, look, I'm sure it's fine, and don't people get credit cards to deal with this stuff? And everyone else seems to be able to afford to have, you know, a car and run it, so I will do that too. That sort of sense of the arts life can look so different to your kind of stock standard, what we might call developmentally normative sort of pathway. The arts world can look so different to that that I think sometimes we can fall into that trap of going, oh, well, this is work and other people are working, so therefore this kind of stuff just happens when you're working. But actually that's not a healthy place to be. Yeah, the other trap I think that people fall into is that sort of when they notice that things are getting a little bit out of whack, they don't necessarily know what to do to pull themselves out of that. So this can go with mental health, it can go with financial stress, it can go with emotional distress, anything. If we notice that we're in a place where we can see the ship sinking, we don't necessarily know what's going to be helpful for us to get out of that. Where is that life raft going to come from? So I think what can be really helpful is sort of accepting that, look, money's going to feel stressful over my career. So having an emergency plan sort of in place so that when you notice that it's a particularly stressful money time for whatever reason, you know what you can do about it. So sort of knowing that there are financial counsellors who are free and they're not financial advisors, and they are there to help people with all these money questions. So just knowing, okay, there's financial counsellors there. So as soon as I begin to feel a little bit wobbly in this territory, I will give them a call or I will seek them out. Or just knowing sort of basic ins and outs in terms of kind of expenses and how economics work. So feeling like you've got that knowledge, it's in your toolbox, but you're ready to go when you do notice that things get a little bit wobbly, because, you know, it's more than likely that it will, or I will say it will be wobbly at some time in your in your career, if not for kind of a constant. It might be a wobbly constant, so really helpful to kind of outsource and know what your support plan is going to be.
Yeah, that's so important. And actually, I was wondering, For you, how has having another profession outside of the arts impact your ability to make art?
One sort of, I guess, big factor is the with ethics. So thinking of working ethically as a psychologist, it would be really inappropriate for me to, you know, work therapeutically with someone and then be in a rehearsal room with them. You kind of, that kind of is not really an appropriate sort of thing to do. I sort of had to make a decision when I started Green Room of, well, what do I want to focus and put my energy on right now? So at that point, I sort of made a decision that I was going to break up with my agent and sort of not actively seek performance work. So it made me sort of, I guess, shift how I engage with my art, which was probably going to be a process that was going to happen anyway. I'm much more interested in creating stories now rather than necessarily being central to the performance of them. So things like, and I think I see it more long-term now too. So rather than being sort of a jobbing art actor and putting myself out there for, you know, the sort of jobs that are available to actors when they're in that position, I'm much more focused now on sort of, there's a couple of projects that I'm sort of on the back burner and I'm constantly sort of devising, writing and kind of just constructing little bits and bobs of. So I guess I'm engaging in my art in a different way, in that I'm now sort of creating stories rather than kind of being more of an end point of the creation project. But also kind of seeing my art as much more long form now. So, you know, if with the couple of stories that I'm creating, if one of them turns into kind of an actual piece or an actual project sometime in the next 10 years, that would be incredibly fulfilling for me. Yeah, but I think it's definitely, it's not changed the way I engage in sort of my own artistic process. I think it's changed more in terms of focus on output.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really, really valuable to hear, because I think having that mindset of being an artist being a lifetime, like something that we are and we don't have to prove ourselves to be and we don't have to constantly maintain it or go about it in the same way, is so important. Because I think that as an emerging artist, there's this sense of like, oh, I have to go all in and I'm a failure if I move out of this space. And, you know, maybe like having to give up everything for your art can be quite normalized. So,
yeah,
it's really fabulous to hear the way that that's evolved for you.
And it's actually funny. I joke with my husband and some of my dear friends who went through Waffle with me. We quite often joke at the moment because we're all sort of around that kind of late 30s, early 40s sort of thing, you know, bumbling our way through family life or whatever it might be. And we often have this little joke of, oh, are we mid-career artists? Is this middle age? Is this sort of mid, but sort of, yeah, realising now that we're there that, yeah, your career will have different phases and they will look different and you will kind of approach it differently and receive things back differently, and that sort of is something that comes with experience and time and self-noticing what you want out of your career, what is the way you like to work, and feeling like you are in a place where you can seek that out.
Thanks for joining me on our first episode of The Feast and the Famine. I'm Georgie, your host. You can connect with the podcast and with me via Instagram at Feast and Famine Podcast. That's F-E-A-S-T-N, so Feast N, F-A-M-I-N-E Podcast. That's where I'll be posting updates about future episodes, some great resources I've found researching this episode, like the Money Personality Quiz, and some extra snippets from interviews. Until next time, take care.